Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, State of the Union, GOP debate, Sanders gains on Clinton, Iran, and those American sailors. President Obama delivered his final State of the Union address with pushback on many fronts on the GOP's dire view. Here's one.
Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction.
Donald Trump and Ted Cruz clashed at last night's Republican debate. Cruz tried to flip the birther issue.
I'm not going to use your mother's birth against you.
Because it wouldn't work.
And three tickets were sold for the record-breaking $1.6 billion Powerball jackpot. They went nuts at the Chino Hills, California 7-Eleven that sold a winner. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Rachel Smolkin of CNN Politics, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What did you see on the GOP stage last night, in the president and his last State of the Union address, in the taking and return of U.S. sailors in the Persian Gulf? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us today from Washington, Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. Rachel, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. And from Des Moines in Iowa, Byron York joins us, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Byron, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Rachel, and Byron.
Front and center last night in the GOP debate in South Carolina, the Ted Cruz, Donald Trump standoff, and Ted Cruz going after Trump for bringing up the birther issue about his birth in Canada.
Back in September, my friend Donald said that he had had his lawyers look at this from every which way, and there was no issue there. There was nothing to this birther issue. Now, since September, the Constitution hasn't changed, but the poll numbers have.
And then the broader punch from Cruz on Donald Trump's, what Cruz called Donald Trump's New York values.
Everyone understands that the values in New York City are socially liberal or pro-abortion or pro-gay marriage, focused around money and the media.
Well, okay, Byron York, start us off here. These two out front in the polls. Donald Trump had been comfortably ahead. Ted Cruz has gained on him substantially in Iowa, in New Hampshire as well, for that matter. What do we see unfolding in the contest between these two front runners, Byron?
Well, first of all, I think it's pretty rare to see a debate in which one candidate just flattens the other. And then later in the debate, the other candidate flattens the other guy. And that's what we saw, actually, with Trump and Cruz last night, where you just played. Cruz, I think, really, really ran all around Trump on the whole birth issue. But later on, Trump just crushed Cruz on this so-called New York values issue. Very odd to see two candidates both deliver really big blows like that. I think this debate showed the further narrowing of the field. First of all, Fox Business narrowed the debate stage to seven people.
Carly
and then I think
out.
We can say that Jeb Bush and John Kasich and Ben Carson weren't really there much last night. So we're really down to four, Trump, Cruz, Rubio, and Christie.
Trump came back very hard on the New York values front, raised the 9/11 image. New Yorkers plunging in there to fight and fight and fight, he said, to rebuild, to dig out from that tragedy. Here was part of that challenge.
New York is a great place. It's got great people. It's got loving people, wonderful people. When the World Trade Center came down, I saw something that no place on earth could have handled more beautifully, more humanely than New York. You had 200.
And that was just the beginning before he was done with that pretty sober response. You had Ted Cruz, who is no mean debater, Princeton champ and all the rest, just kind of left with a sick smile on his face. Rachel Smolkin, what about that the standoff here last night?
That was an incredibly powerful moment, the one you just played the sound, and a different side of Donald Trump than sometimes we see on the trail. You know, you hear the word bluster associated with him a lot. He really stopped. He was speaking slower than usual, and just an incredibly eloquent and powerful retort to Ted Cruz in that moment did flatten him. That was such a good way to put it. I would say on the earlier exchange, while I completely agree that that was deftly handled by Ted Cruz, the birther issue. His retorts were good. He was clearly ready for the issue. You could see those champion debate skills coming out. But still important to note that they were playing there on Donald Trump's turf. Ted Cruz has been very disciplined in his campaign. That's one of the reasons we've seen him gaining ground the way he has. And he has been completely knocked off message by the birther debate. So he had to move over and address this issue that he absolutely doesn't want to be talking about. Now, having said that, he handled it as well as he possibly could have, I think, in that moment. But it's one of these, you know, he won the battle, did he win the war? Is he going to be able to now move on? Or are we going to just see that birther issue come back again and again? Donald Trump did not give any sign last night that he's ready to drop this issue.
Jack Beatty, Nikki Haley, in her response to the president's State of the Union speech on Tuesday night, coming out with a very thinly veiled, and later another interview is not veiled at all, kind of attack on Donald Trump, and others saying too much anger here, and we've got to take our own portion of the blame and settle down. But last night on that GOP stage, it was Trump and Cruz, it seemed once again, as Byron York says, out front. What is the drama that's unfolding here, and is there any slowdown in the kind of non-mainstream, non-establishment juggernaut that appears to be underway?
Well, you know, Tom, watching Ted Cruz's mastery of debate, I was reminded of a comment made by the young Winston Churchill. He said he prevailed in cabinet, quote, by flair based on previous study. Cruz really, other than the backfire shot at New York values, displayed flair, study, wit, but also what David Brooks calls his brutalism, slandering President Obama as an apologist for Islamic terrorism. And Marco Rubio really effectively exposed a Cruz liability, his 16% national sales tax, as it will be stigmatized in attack ads. You know, Churchill used his flair to persuade the Asquith cabinet to invade Gallipoli. Cruz's sales tax may be his Gallipoli.
Nikki Haley saying, hey, let's watch out for the siren call of the angriest voices in that Tuesday night reply to President Obama. Trump responded to that in the debate last night. But first, here was Haley Tuesday night.
Today, we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation.
Boy, she's interesting. The South Carolina governor, Robert Costa, in the Washington Post says, watch that space as a potential VP candidate on a ticket with whoever comes out of the Republican rumble. But Donald Trump last night was just doubling down on the anger label. No apologies.
I will gladly accept the mantle of anger. Our military is a disaster. Our health care is a horror show. Obamacare, we're going to repeal it and replace it. We have no borders. Our vets are being treated horribly. Illegal immigration is beyond belief. Our country is being run by incompetent people. And yes, I am angry.
Byron York, give us some analysis here on the anger card. It's being played effectively by Trump and by Cruz. And on this establishment, what's been described as a panic over these two, not just Trump, but these two in the lead. You talked with Donald Trump this week, Byron, and asked him if he was really a conservative. You said conservatives don't believe you're one of them. What's going on?
Well, first of all, this Haley response to the president's State of the Union address really divided Republicans a lot. You saw the establishment Republicans like Jeb Bush cheer her on and say, thank you very much. Time somebody said that. She was probably also speaking for Speaker Paul Ryan. I think those are his views as well. But supporters of Ted Cruz, supporters of Donald Trump, who just happened to be the top two candidates in the race, one, they were angry at it. And two, they thought it was the wrong time to be dumping on Republicans. You know, as far as this anger card is concerned, what strikes me as when you go to Trump rallies and you talk to people, you watch him, you see how they interact, they are desperate for leadership. And they feel that Donald Trump, I know he doesn't offer details on his policies. There are all these gaps. There are changes from his past positions. But they think he's a strong leader and the other ones are weak. And I think that is the absolute foundation of his support, which is not going to change.
But go to the Civil War and the GOP. We've had David Frum on recently talking about that. You yourself put it to Trump this week. You said, look, Mr. Trump, the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, National Review, they don't think you're a conservative. And you know Ted Cruz has lots of detractors, sitting Republicans. Of course, the wacko bird label that John McCain tried to hang on him. What happens if it's one of these guys to the Republican Party, Republican policy, Byron?
Well, look, we have seen prominent conservatives, among them Bill Kristol of the Weekly Standard, say that if Trump were the nominee, they would consider starting a third party. Not Trump in a third party, but yeah, the other guys in a third party.
The party as a third party.
Yeah, it's really there are serious divisions there. And Trump told me, he said, yes, I'm a conservative. He stressed his fiscal conservatism. A lot of conservatives would not really buy that from some of his other issues. But you have to remember, Trump is keying into such anger, not about conservatism, but with the Republican Party. Trump has come out and said the Iraq War was a disaster. A lot of George W. Bush was a disaster. Maybe we could raise some taxes on the very, very richest. We're not going to cut Social Security. Mm-hmm. We're not going to cut Medicare. That's very, very different from the sort of establishment conservative think tank world in Washington.
Rachel, what if he wins it and he's so far off the old reservation and, as Byron says, a lot of upset Republicans are cheering him on?
Absolutely, they are. And that's the power of Trump. He's not trying to fit into a party mold. He's not trying to make the establishment Republicans happy, quite the contrary. And to watch last night was so striking because we went from a place from his announcement that he was going to run for president. And of course, the media has dismissed him to where we are today and his dominance of the field. All the more striking, his strongest debate last night.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the State of the Union, the GOP debate, Sanders gaining on Hillary Clinton, Iran, and those U.S. sailors. Rachel Smolkin is with us from CNN Politics, Byron York from the Washington Examiner, Jack Beatty is here. You can join us as well. What did you think of the debate? What's going on with Bernie and Hillary? What did you think of the way Barack Obama painted America and the world Tuesday night? Did he tell it like it is? Have to ask about Ted Cruz and the somewhere up to $1 million loan that he took from Goldman Sachs, where his wife worked, and maybe Citigroup as well. The New York Times putting that on the front page this week in scandal mode. Ted Cruz saying no scandal. He just hadn't filed. He'd filed it. It was transparent. He said filed it when he ran for Senate. He had missed the federal filing disclosure. Here he is.
It is an inadvertent filing question. The facts of the underlying matter had been disclosed for many, many years. It is not complicated. Our finances are not complicated.
Okay, Rachel, is this a scandal or not?
This was a strong moment for Ted Cruz last night. I don't think it's a scandal. It certainly raises the question of whether a candidate who is running as a populist has their message hurt in any way by a disclosure that they're getting help by Goldman Sachs. But having said that, he took on the issue last night. He handled it candidly. He walked viewers through exactly what had happened and managed to attack both Hillary Clinton in the New York Times in that same answer. We've seen him deftly before take an issue that seems like a vulnerability and turn it to an advantage. He's been fundraising off this issue. He did that again last night. It was a moment where we saw those strong debate skills you mentioned on display.
Jack, it's frustrating. This was he trying to duck the association with Goldman Sachs, or is it just a paperwork oversight? He's been transparent. You know, which is it? There's a kind of credibility issue here. He had talked at the time of the campaign about how he and his wife Heidi, who works at Goldman Sachs, had, like, I forget what the phrase was, but like spent their last pennies or whatever it was. Ducking or not ducking here?
ducking and blaming what the New York Times, which is always a winning card in a Republican debate. He hasn't heard the last of this. Marco Rubio, his people tweeted about this. Unreported seven-figure Goldman Sachs loans are standard for authentic anti-establishment leaders, right? Right, Bueller? We're going to hear more about it. And the idea was, you know, an inadvertent miss that I didn't include it with, I didn't file this with the FEC. That's not going to stand up. At least it's going to get criticized.
I want to circle back to the Republican view of the world, those U.S. Navy sailors and Iran. But let's get the Democratic side of the ledger in here as well. Interesting poll numbers coming out there showing big gains by Bernie Sanders, really substantial just since last month, and especially in Iowa and New Hampshire, but not only there. Hillary Clinton's campaign released an ad ahead of Tuesday night's State of the Union address, aligning her solidly with President Obama on gun policy, challenging Bernie Sanders to pick a side, said the ad.
It's time to pick a side. Either we stand with the gun lobby, or we join the president and stand up to them. I'm with him.
Bernie Sanders punched back on MSNBC on Wednesday.
To say that I'm kind of a supporter of the NRA is really a mean-spirited and unfair and inaccurate statement.
And on Monday in Iowa said, look, Hillary's getting nervous.
I think the most important point to be made is that Secretary Clinton and her campaign now know that she is in serious trouble. And I think a candidate who was originally thought to be the anointed candidate, to be the inevitable candidate, is now locked in a very difficult race here in Iowa and in New Hampshire.
Rachel Smolkin, what do you make of Bernie Sanders' poll numbers rising so sharply against Hillary just in this last month as we come into the last weeks before the voting and caucus begin, at the same time that Bill Clinton has come out on the campaign trail, long anticipated? What's going on here?
The summer of Sanders and the excitement around Sanders last summer has obviously not faded. This race has tightened. The Clinton campaign is increasingly nervous about it. They're just not resonating in the same way. Her voters don't have the same sense of urgency. We're not seeing the same sense of grassroots excitement. And surely she's feeling echoes of 2008 right now. We'll see if she can pull out of that. She's good when the moment gets tough. We've seen some of her best work. So this debate that's coming up on Sunday will be a fascinating one. But she has definitely sharpened her attacks on him in the past week, 2 weeks. We've seen her go from virtually ignoring him, from acting as though she is the has won the nomination, she's ready for the general, to really engaging with him, to painting him as out of step with the party on issues of guns and health care. And we see him trying to figure out how to handle that. He's pledged to run a positive campaign. We saw an ad for him from him this week that certainly skirts that line of running a positive campaign, trying to draw a sharp contrast with Hillary Clinton and defend himself, while at the same time staying true to the image of himself that he's portrayed as someone who's going to stay positive.
Byron York, how do you interpret this turn of events, at least in the polls? I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign not even trying to disguise their unease about this, the campaign manager putting out a note to would-be potential supporters asking for money and say, I don't want to say the sky is falling, but kind of is.
Yes, that's absolutely true. That's a note, an email to small contributors from Robbie Mook, the campaign manager of the Clinton campaign. Look, the theory of the race in the Clinton campaign has always been that you know, maybe she won't do great in Iowa, New Hampshire, but beginning in South Carolina and continuing from there, she has a firewall in these states because those states and the ones beyond have larger numbers of black Democrats to vote, and she has an enormously strong support among black Democrats. Black Democrats are a huge and critical part of the Democratic coalition. So when the voting gets down there, she's going to win. Now, what has changed a little bit, I think, is that the Sanders people believe, and I was talking to them yesterday, they believe that early victories, they don't say he's going to win Iowa, but they say doing well in Iowa, and clearly he's within the margin of error now, doing well in Iowa and winning New Hampshire would change the dynamic of the race and that the firewall could crumble, that more people would take a look at Sanders than did before. And I think there's no doubt that Clinton is much more concerned than she was before. And one thing we should mention is you saw the emergence of Chelsea Clinton, who has kind of a sainted status among Democrats, coming out and attacking Bernie, in this case over health care, suggesting that Sanders' health care plan would somehow play into the hands of Republicans who want to repeal Obamacare. Probably not a realistic kind of criticism, but nonetheless, the fact was Chelsea Clinton was out bashing Bernie. So clearly something is going on inside the Clinton campaign.
Maybe a sainted status, certainly young, like a lot of Sanders supporters. I don't know how much throw weight is there. I mean, Jack Beatty, there's all this talk about the Civil War in the Republican Party, but here these two are going at it pretty well in the polls. Even Joe Biden got into it. This was Tuesday, talking with NBC. He said that Bernie Sanders' focus on income inequality has struck a chord with voters. I don't know how much he meant by this, but people came out and said, oh, well, there's Biden throwing his weight behind Sanders. I'm not sure, but just listen to a bit of that.
And she is coming up with some very good ideas. But Bernie is pushing the envelope on this and for everyone involved.
She's been engaged in foreign policy, Biden said. He's been focused on income inequality. What's going on, Jack?
You know, Tom, as you say, in the last 30 days since the Chatterati really declared her the winner of the last debate, in those last 30 days, she's lost 20 points in national polls, forfeited really her comfortable lead in Iowa to Sanders, and trails him in the latest New Hampshire poll by 14 points. What happened? Conjecture one. She listened to the talking heads and didn't run hard against Sanders until this week when the polls appeared. Conjecture two. The big dog got off the porch. Bill Clinton hit the campaign trail, and Donald Trump's abuser charge reminded Democrats of what they'd rather forget. Conjecture three, Bernie Sanders, the party outsider, actually represents the views of the base better than Clinton, a friend of privilege, out of tune with the anti-oligarchy temper of the party.
Okay, how much weight do you put on the Trump pushback there, talking about Bill Clinton as an abuser and Hillary Clinton as an enabler of abuse of women?
Well, that's out there. We don't know. We don't have any measure on that. It is interesting, though, that Republican hierarchs, according to Rich Lowry of the National Review, are impressed by these attacks on Clinton as an abuser. They feel that Trump would run a tougher race against Hillary than Ted Cruz.
Let's go to Ken in Ticonderoga, New York. Famous name. Ken, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Just called in to, take issue with the comment about Bernie being close. Bernie's not close. Bernie's way ahead. You got to look at methodology in the polling. You got to lift the hood, take a look at how it's structured. They underweight millennials who are going to be huge this time around. They're not counting people that voted unless they voted in Democratic primaries in 2008 or 2004. So stay tuned.
You think he's the big winner, but we heard John Kasich say on the GOP debate stage last night, Ken, that if Bernie is the candidate, Democrats...
Party affiliation declaration on the day of the caucuses, you're going to see Indies and Republicans cross over to vote for Bernie 2016.
Ken, we've got it. Jeff in Dubuque, Iowa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. A couple things regarding the candidates. I mean, we've had a lot of time in Iowa to look at them, but two images. First, Mr. Trump. To me, he is the king who's wearing no clothes. And
why? He's got some nice suits.
Well, first of all, he has no political constituency. I mean, he's only going to run by presidential executive order because he doesn't have a following. He doesn't understand.
You mean in Congress? He's got a constituency in the country if the polls are anywhere.
Not in Congress. So how is he going to govern the country? Basically by executive order. And that, to me, is more like a kingship rather than respect for the democracy.
Let us look at that. That's interesting because last night he specifically went at this. Obama, again, on executive order, says that's not the way it's supposed to work. You're supposed to work with Congress. Byron, can you imagine him getting the nomination? And if he should take it, how would it work?
Well, first of all, I disagree with what Jeff was saying there, because this is all based on the premise that Trump won. Okay, well, if Trump wins the presidency, mm-hmm. voters have a way of bringing office holders around. And
yeah, but they
Trump
would have elected
already...
him, and you know that his positions do not line up with people who couldn't even take John Boehner in Congress.
Well, but remember, a president's strongest argument with Congress, the one that kind of ends the conversation, which is, and that's why the American people elected me. The entire nation elected me. Some district elected you, or maybe a state elected you, but I'm the president. That's very, very strong. So, the harder thing to believe, of course, is that Trump actually wins the nomination and then wins the White House. I don't really think that he would have that much trouble having some Republicans on his side in Congress.
Rachel Smolkin, that hard to believe he would win the nomination. We keep hearing that from Republicans. And Trump keeps leading the polls. I mean, there's Cruz challenging him, but he's still out there.
That's right. We keep hearing that despite all evidence to the contrary. And I think that comment is a very good example of what we see going on. He doesn't have a constituency, certainly not in the traditional political sense. That's exactly what people like about him, what his supporters like about him, that he defies all these rules, that he's not, in their view, beholden to special interests or a particular set of allies in the Congress. And at the same time, that's one of the many things that infuriates establishment Republicans about him. He's not playing by the rules, in addition to all the other things that he's doing, which in their view has the potential to blow up the party and hurt the rest of them as they're trying to run their own races for re-election.
A fair amount of talk on the Republican stage last night about national security, going in particular at Barack Obama's portrayal of the world, this kind of slow, steady, patient response to ISIS, not the flamboyant response, the president saying, don't overblow it. That just plays into their hands. Here was Marco Rubio saying, when he's president, it'll be different.
And when I'm president, we're not just going to have a president that gives a State of the Union and says America's the greatest country in the world. When I'm president, we're going to have a president that acts like it.
Thank you, Senator.
Bing, bing. But I want to look at this. The president was very clear on this. It was really kind of calling out Chris Christie with his World War III language about ISIS. Christie staying on that track last night. But here was the president in his final State of the Union address on Tuesday night.
As we focus on destroying ISIS, over-the-top claims that this is World War III just play into their hands.
Byron York, what about these very different portrayals of the world? You heard once again Republicans not backing off with this dire, dire depiction, both of the condition of the USA, Donald Trump certainly on that vein, and of the U.S. standing and security standing in the world. Explain the chasm.
Well, huge contrast that we saw in the President's State of the Union address and the debate last night. I do think it's fair to say that the Republican race and particularly Trump kind of loomed over the president's address. But, you know, an interesting moment happened at the very first minute of the debate last night in which Ted Cruz got the first question. It was about the economy, and he talked about Iran.
Yep.
he talked about how outrageous it was to see pictures of American sailors on their knees with their hands up over their heads in the custody of the Iranians. And this was outrageous, and this was particularly outrageous because Barack Obama was going to give $150 billion in sanctions relief to the Iranians, and this kind of thing would not happen in his presidency. And you saw all of the Republicans say something very, very similar to that. So even though this Iranian hostage crisis lasted, I don't know what, 12 hours or so, and the Americans were released, this was a very vivid image that the Republicans used to push this their position on not just Iran, but Obama's view of the world.
Jack Beatty, who loomed over who this week when it comes to the depiction of the world? I mean, the president was very deliberate in trying to paint the Republicans as dark and pessimistic and said, that's not the American way. We have great, bright, basic strengths. The Republicans coming back dark and pessimistic. Whose view sort of takes that wrestling match?
Well, I think it's very hard for the president to defend himself against sensation, against headlines, against things like these sailors, you know, being taken, being impounded.
Yeah, but they weren't held for 400 days. Maybe they did drift in there. Iran did let them go. John Kerry could call and talk with the Iranians.
It's true. It's true. On the other hand, some people think that the photographs of them violated the Geneva Convention. It says you can't treat prisoners in a way that insults with insults and public curiosity, and displaying them may have violated that. And the Secretary
of Defense... It was hardly Abu Ghraib photos there, Jack.
Hardly. But the but Ash Carter, not for the last time, our Secretary of Defense, was less than, what should one say, full-throated in his comment. He said, around the world, the U.S. Navy routinely provides assistance to foreign sailors in distress, and we appreciate the timely way in which the situation was resolved. Well, the president is vulnerable to these kinds of things, and the whole Democratic campaign is vulnerable to another terrorist outrage.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, The Revenant takes the most Oscar nominations, and at the Golden Globes, Empire star Taraji P. Henson won Best Actress in a TV Series and was not ready to wrap up her moment of glory.
Please wrap. Wait a minute. I waited 20 years for this. You gonna wait? Yeah, you gonna give me a little more time?
She got her time. The St. Louis Rams are moving back to Los Angeles. Tough for St. Louis. But Compton resident Gabriel Martinez never stopped holding a flame for the Rams when they left L.A.
I was really sad, I was still a Rams fan. I was hoping they'd come back, and my wishes came true.
And British actor Alan Rickman is dead at 69, best known for his roles in Die Hard and Love Actually, and of course in the Harry Potter films as Severus Snape.
Mr. Potter, our new celebrity. Tell me, what would I get if I added powdered root of asphodel to an infusion of wormwood?
We're looking at a week in the news with Rachel Smolkin of CNN, Byron York of the Washington Examiner, Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. Are we getting used to ISIS throwing bombs all over Istanbul and Jakarta this week, to starving Syrians, those terrible images out of besieged cities in Syria? Should El Chapo be in an American prison? Mexico may be moving toward extradition this week. Should you have won Powerball? Just a little sound here of those explosions and gunfire hitting the Indonesian capital of Jakarta on Thursday. Officials said coordinated by Islamic State-linked terrorists. And the national security thing right in the spotlight again with that. Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. I think, sadly, we are getting too used to the images and news of ISIS doing just about every act of terrorism that you see around the world. But getting back to the State of the Union, I'm with the president, even for no reason other than the economy, because it seems to be better now than it was, you know, I mean, back in 2008. Nobody predicted that we would be doing as good as we are now.
The president with some big numbers to brag on there, though he and Republicans, you heard John Kasich last night acknowledging that a lot of people still don't feel it like they might. Byron, how do you see the economy playing out? The employment numbers were good. Unemployment is way down. Look at other countries. I mean, the stock market's been roiled because China's in trouble lately. And the president said, come on, we are the strong one here. How's that roll out, Byron?
Well, first of all, to agree with what Bob said, the economy is indisputably better than it was in 2009. I mean, it was a disaster. It was really, really, really bad.
At the end of 8 years of Republican holding the White House.
That is correct. But I think what's interesting is to see this what the president says about the economy. The president's glass half full or rose-colored scenario, whatever you want to call it. to see that play out in both the Republican and the Democratic race. We've been talking a lot about the Republicans, mm-hmm. but you know, if you listen to the Democrats on the stump and on their debate stages, they talk about a middle class squeeze, about Americans not being able to get ahead, about Americans stuck with just living paycheck to paycheck, just trying to make ends meet.
And so, Bernie Sanders much more than a squeeze, like a disastrous problem.
Absolutely, and if you did a word cloud of a Bernie Sanders speech, millionaires and billionaires would be, you know, this huge part of the cloud. And so the rich are taking everything, and we need to change this. So it's interesting. The two parties that are vying to succeed Barack Obama do not subscribe to his rosier view of the condition of the economy.
And the president, of course, himself, Bob in Bloomington, Indiana, wants to think a little more about the State of the Union address. The president making a lot in that address of his failure, one of his few regrets, he said, that he couldn't bridge the divide between himself and Republicans in Washington. Let's listen for a minute to that.
It's one of the few regrets of my presidency, that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. I have no doubt a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office.
Jack, a moment of kind of, you know, baring his chest and saying, look, I could have been better at this. There was tough criticism of the GOP in this speech as well, but the president trying to reach out even now, at least rhetorically there. What did you make of that moment?
Well, you know, Tom, in his call for comity, the president, many commentators said, appealed to, quote, the better angels of our nature. The phrase is from Abraham Lincoln. He used it to end his first inaugural on March 4, 1861, which was just 2 weeks after Jefferson Davis had been sworn in as the first president mm-hmm. of the Confederacy. I am loath to close, Lincoln said. Then he addressed the South. We are not enemies, but friends. 2 weeks later came the bombardment of Fort Sumter and Civil War. You know, Lincoln's words couldn't unite the sundered nation any more than Obama's can heal the rancor of a politics that 80% of Americans now say is more polarized than ever. A recent paper by two political scientists really brings home the virulence. For a growing percentage of Americans, they write, negative feelings toward the opposing party outweigh positive feelings for their own party. They coined a term for this, negative partisanship. Negative partisans, voters whose loyalty to one party is based largely on their repugnance for the other, they now outnumber positive partisans. You know, Democrats and Republicans increasingly see each other as enemies, not friends. The better angels have flown away.
Fellow citizens, please. Randy in Norman, Oklahoma. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I feel that comparing the president's State of the Union to the debate last night, the president makes everything sound so rosy, a lot like telling the band to play on at the Titanic scene. And the Republicans, they're more in touch with the way our country appears nowadays, where people aren't educated enough to fill out a job application, to find a job. The world so much darker place than the president leads everybody to believe.
And you're just not buying it. The band playing as the Titanic sinks. Rachel Smolkin, step back here. Of course, there is a powerful interest for an outgoing, not so long from now, president to say things are looking good. Morning in America. And of course, there is a powerful interest for those who want to come in from the other party to say things are terrible. Things are miserable. We've got to change. Can you make a judgment on the facts, or maybe it's just a judge on who's the better master of theater?
Well, I think the Republicans would definitely have used that line about the Titanic sinking last night if only they had thought of it. They would have liked that one. Two radically different visions of America that we've seen this week. The president issuing a powerful final plea and a very different State of the Union address. He didn't even bother to put out the usual laundry list of domestic policy asks because it was so clear they were not going to go anywhere, and instead used it as a moment to both defend his legacy, to advance the way he wants to be remembered, and also to really directly take on Donald Trump and the Republicans, the others who are running as well, but primarily Donald Trump, to say this is not his vision of America. And he denounced the political hot air even while pushing back against it. And we talked earlier about the line of peddling fiction. So that was the view the president addressed. He really hit hard at what he sees as the divisive politics. Of course, he, in hitting hard with them, it could be argued that he was not unifying the country in that way either. So he did encounter some criticism for that. The Republicans putting forth a really different and darker vision of the country. They see Americans as vulnerable, and it's very important to understand that's resonating with the country. When Donald Trump says, I want to feel safe and secure, so do Americans. And we had the contrast point of the president's speech followed by this very visually powerful image of the sailors on their knees with their hands over their heads. And that's why we heard about that so often during the debate last night.
It was the sound of those sailors apologizing off the boat. Of course, this is Iranian television. Who knows what all circumstances were, but here's one of them.
It was a mistake. That was our fault. And we apologize for our mistake.
And even so, I have to say, you look at this country, you look at its position in the world, there seems so much reason for optimism. I don't know if the president's got it right, but if you get too dark, you can psych yourself out too. Vaz in Detroit. Vaz, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, it was the irony with Ted Cruz opening the statement about the Iranian situation was if he were president, we'd have a terrible relationship with Iran, and those soldiers would probably still be in captivity, probably looking at imprisonment or something worse, because the relationship wouldn't be there, and the deal with the nuclear end of the nuclear program for the lifting of sanctions wouldn't be there, and Ted Cruz would put those soldiers at risk.
That is an interesting point. I mean, Byron, under which leader would you rather be at the moment when you've drifted and you're taken on, you know, I suppose, a different relationship that could have sat in an Iranian prison for a long time or else be in the middle of a war?
Well, I think the Republicans have a very strong argument about the state of the world under President Obama. Look at – especially after Paris and after San Bernardino. Now we're just talking about Jakarta. And then there was Istanbul. I mean, it's not good. If you look at voters a year ago, all voters, when asked, what is the most important issue for you in this presidential race, the economy was always at the top. That has really flipped with Republican voters. National security and terrorism are by far the top issue for them, and it's becoming more so with independents. Democrats, I believe, still list the economy as their top issue. But there's no doubt that among all voters, national security is becoming a bigger and bigger thing. And a lot of Americans, I believe, don't believe that the president is prosecuting the fight against ISIS with the vigor and intensity that he could. And so I think you're going to see Republicans continue to go on this because they genuinely believe it's a serious issue.
I mean, on the other hand, you look at the Iraq war, and serious analysts here, including those from the conservative camp, have said the blowback here is what brought us ISIS. You know, that blustering militarism can also bring problems, and it's been a tough lesson on that front. The president's point, we're trying to do this step by step, button things up. John Kerry making that same argument this week. They've got, what do they call it, implementation day coming on the Iraq nuclear deal. And Kerry saying that the sort of chain of tracking of nuclear material will be so complete that we'll be in a new circumstance. Here he was on Wednesday in Washington.
The IAEA will build up its capacity to inspect and know what Iran is doing. And for 25 years, we'll be tracking every bit of uranium that is processed from the mine to the mill to the gas to the yellow cake to the centrifuge and into the waste.
Jack Beatty, who's serious here? Wave the military threat to cow others or, you know, step by step, button up deals?
Well, we seem to have signed, a major deal here. Peter Kenyon calls it in NPR a significant accomplishment. The Arak plutonium reactor now capped with cement. The nuclear fuel, uranium, according to Kent Kerry, all of the enriched materials been put on a ship, taken out, and gone to Russia for processing. One analyst, Mark Fitzpatrick of the London International Institute, says It's a very big non-proliferation step. Well, the nuclear dimension is the most threatening, and we have made a big step in neutralizing that threat. That's a significant achievement.
Chris in Des Moines, Iowa. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had been listening to your program, and they were talking about negative partisanship. And I just wanted to point out, I'm from Des Moines. I'm seeing a lot of politics going on right in my hometown. I'm a positive partisan. I think things are going well, and we are making progress despite all kind of the negative media out there. And I just wanted to say that, you know, I appreciate all the work that the president has done. I don't agree with him on completely everything that he's done. But I just think that if we would all work together, we would get a lot more done. We would all feel more positive about everything that goes on, whether it be terrorism, the economy, whatever it might be. And I would just like to see a lot more of that. I thought from the Republican debate last night, Kasich made the best case for something like that. And I think that, you know, as a country, we need to come together. And that's the most important thing for this election.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Plenty of room always for criticism. But in the end, somehow you've got to figure out how to work together. Rachel, what about Byron York's observation here that you've got Democrats, Bernie Sanders in particular, arguing just the other way on the economy, that it's just so lousy for so many Americans that it's got to be really turned over? How does that play out against the president's message of strength and long-term hope?
It plays into the anti-establishment fervor that we're seeing this year on both sides of the aisle. And it's one of the reasons that Sanders has been more successful than expected. He's tapped into that, the same kind of anxiety we're seeing on the Republican side. We're seeing, although to a lesser degree, but definitely still there on the Democratic side. And he's successfully tapped into that, painting Hillary Clinton as an establishment figure who's going to continue the status quo while he wants to shake it up. Obviously, Hillary Clinton will have a few things to say about that this weekend when they debate.
Byron York, here we are. The voting begins in just a handful of weeks now. Who feels better positioned to you looking toward next November?
Well, you know, if you're covering the Republican race, you're just thinking about February 1st and then February 9th and then February 20th, the Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina votes. A lot of Republicans, I think, are beginning to try to get their head around the possibility of Donald Trump winning the Republican nomination. And I was just earlier looking at the polls from Howard Dean back in 2004, saying, you know, when did he start to collapse? Is something going to happen with Trump? We just don't know. Right now, Trump continues to look very, very strong.
I somehow can't see Donald Trump giving that battle cry that somehow unraveled Howard Dean there. But we'll see. What a time. What a time. Byron York with the Washington Examiner. Great to have you with us today. Chief political correspondent there. Thank you for joining us, Byron, from Des Moines.
Thank you, Tom.
Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. Thank you for being here, Rachel.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Jack, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Bowie bowing out this week at 69. We go out with his Changes, 1971. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.